Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge, and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. I'm continuing on with my series where I make sure I have read and reviewed all of what I called last time out the Hugula Award winners, which is a Hugo and Nebula award-winning novel. The same novel that won both of the two major, I was going to say fan awards. One of them is an award voted for by science fiction readers. And the other one, the Nebulas, is one that's voted for by science fiction writers and authors and other people like that. So you think putting these two together, the books that have won both of these awards would be the best awards of the time. Maybe. Well, we'll see how it goes. So I have read and reviewed quite a lot of them already. Let me look at the list here. So, yes, now I've gotten to 17 of 22 that have been read and reviewed after I do this one. And then there's another few books, and three of those, of the five left over, I have read before. Is that the way? Yes, and then two of them I have not read before, not started before. So this time out, I'm reviewing the book which won the Hugo Award and the Nebula Award back in 1980 Hugo Award and the 1979 Nebula Award for Best Novel, which is The Fountains of Paradise by Arthur C. Clarke. Now, I've not read a lot of these, read a lot of books by Arthur C. Clarke for the SFBRP, generally because I read most of his books, or all of his books, I think all of his published science fiction books before I started reading this, except maybe the last one. His last ever book. I've not read that yet, but I read all the rest of them before I actually started doing the SFBRP. So it's always going to be a reread when I get to one of his science fiction books that I know of. Maybe there's a few that slipped through the cracks. This is The Fountains of Paradise, and it's well known as the space elevator, orbital tower book. Let me go across to my notes so I get all this right. Yeah, so I listened to this as an audiobook. I got it from Audible. I'll talk more about that in a bit. I've read it before as a paperback, this time out as an audiobook. And to be honest, I think I enjoyed it a little bit more as an audiobook, and also because I kind of knew what was coming up. So it starts off, the book, all of the action for the book, or 99% of the action in the book, takes place in Taprobani, which is kind of like a slightly fictionalized Sri Lanka. And I say it happens in there. Some of it happens above there because, of course, there's a space elevator which is built above Taprobani. So I guess it happens in the airspace. I don't know what the air rights are. You know what they have at in New York and these other cities, they have air rights where you can sell the space above your building and you get these overhanging buildings, which is pretty weird. So in the air rights of a fictionalized Sri Lanka, and it starts off with a character who was a top UN kind of person. He was a top diplomat, someone called Singh. I can't remember his first name. He's well known, and he lives in a place called Yakagala, which is like a fictionalized version of a ruin, a royal ruin, and that sits on top of this rock, and there's all these pleasure gardens. He lives close by with this big rock which sticks up 100 meters or 200 meters or 300 meters, however high it is, above the surrounding plains, right in the center of Taprobani, which is like Sri Lanka. And this is based on a real place, and he's there and he's hanging out, and he gets a visitor one day, and the visitor is a guy called Vannevar Morgan. And Vannevar Morgan used to be in charge, or is currently in charge, of the Terran construction, land-based Terran construction corporation. Development Corporation, and he has just finished up building the Gibraltar Bridge, which is a big bridge that goes between, I guess it's across the Straits of Gibraltar. It probably doesn't go from Gibraltar across to North Africa, somewhere across the Straits of Gibraltar. And he's built this bridge, and it talks a bit about him, and he meets up, and they meet up, and they go and learn a little bit about the history of Yakagala, this royal gardens on top of this rock. And it tells the history of this king there who built all of these palaces and royal gardens all the way around, called King Kalidasa. And again, all of these things, King Kalidasa is based on a real person as well. I just looked up on Wikipedia, called Kashyapa. So there was a King Kashyapa, and in the book it's King Kalidasa. So they learn a bit about them, and we get quite a few flashbacks to King Kalidasa and what he was doing. And King Kalidasa was a visionary who was like, hey, I want to build fountains, and I want to build gardens, and I want to build these pictures here. I want to recreate heaven. I want to create heaven here in Taprobane, here in Yakagala, and that's what I'm going to do. So we get this, and so that is kind of a thematic link between Kalidasa and then Vannevar Morgan, who is like, hey, I want to also access heaven through Taprobane, but I'm going to do this by building a space elevator. And so the old story that we find out about this this King Kalidasa is kind of echoed, some of the themes are echoed with the main story, which is of Vannevar Morgan, who is our main guy. He's our protagonist throughout the main section of the story. He wants to build a space elevator, and he wants to connect ground level with something in geostationary orbit and have a big tether, a bridge. Between geostationary orbit and the Earth. And what does it take to be that way? Of course, we see someone who will, in Kalidasa, we see what kind of person it takes to build these amazing fountains and these amazing other things and this and that. You know, it's all reflected partially in Vannevar Morgan. So the story is actually, let me take a sip of a drink here. So the story is actually quite simple. He goes, right, hey, Singh, ex-diplomat Singh, I want to build a space elevator, and it has to go up from exactly on the equator, and there's this hill, which is the perfect one. Nowhere else is exactly right. That has to be it because of I can't even say the word now. In the gravity around the world, and this is the place. The other place is going to be exactly opposite in the Pacific Ocean, but otherwise, right here in Sri Lanka, in Taprobane, that's where it has to be. However, there's a problem. There's some on the top of the hill, which isn't Yakagala. It's actually Srikanda, I think it's called, a mountain which kind of exists in Sri Lanka, but it's kind of been renamed from Sripada to Srikanda. Yes, we're gonna go there, but there's a monastery on the top there, but I want to build there anyway, you know, and that's a bit like the first half of the book, or the first two-thirds of the book, is him going, right, we need this location, we need the funding, we need to work out if the science works, and are we going to go ahead with the building of the space elevator? And he gets help from different people. There's a journalist who helps him out, there's a king of the North African Republic kind of place, big, you know, where the Sahara used to be is now being flooded, and there's a sea there, and I guess there's oil wealth or whatever's happening there. They help pay for the Gibraltar Bridge, and there's other technicians, and there's other politicians from Mars, and hey, we're going to go here and go there, and he works it out. So that's the first part of the book, and then the second part, which is about the last third of the book, we skip forward to a time when the elevator is almost finished, but something goes wrong. And there's a rescue attempt, and that takes up the end of the book. And Vannevar Morgan is then quite a bit older. And once again, we kind of follow him through to the future, into his future, and what he's like when he's older, and how far they're going with the project that he's working on. And there's a few people going, oh, well, it'd be great when it's finished, but it's going to take so long to build because it's so long. It's 38,000 kilometers long, or whatever it is. And it's going to take a lot to finish this, and maybe we won't be alive when it's finished. That's not Vannevar Morgan who's saying that. He's going, yes, I will be alive. I will see this completed. But there's other characters who are like, hey, maybe I'm not going to be alive. I'll help fund it, but I might not be alive. So what else have we got to go on? I want to get more into the technology about it, so that's what this book is about. But the story is quite simple. There's not, like I say, it's not a very long book, which is good, and such a simple story probably wouldn't have been able to be sustained much further, because it isn't, the story isn't the driving force. It feels very much like the Rendezvous with Rama, in a way, where when Juliana and I were talking about that, it's like, well, the story is like they go and they explore and that's what happens and they do it. And then at the end, you're like, oh, we need a crisis at the end. Quick, have a crisis for the last third of the book or the last quarter of the book. Crisis, 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 crisis resolved. And now we can move on. And it's like, great, no problem. And that's kind of what goes on here as well. You get all the way through to that point and suddenly they're like, oh, but we need some kind of crisis at the end. Ah, let's have an emergency on the space elevator and someone needs to go up and sort that kind of stuff out. The fun thing is that because it's so much about the space elevator, there's hardly like a chapter in the book where it isn't focusing completely on the space elevator and the people building it and how it's funded and the political machinations and what to do with the priests and what to do with this other thing over here. And we've got lots of things to think about, What are we going to do with all of this? It's so much about the space elevator that when it comes to the drama at the space elevator at the end, it's like, ah, all of the first part of the book was for the planning and we get the big picture stuff. But now, how is it actually going to work like on a day-to-day basis? Or how is it going to be built like literally like down to the nuts and bolts? Like how are these things connected together? What is this going to look like? How is that going to go? How long does it take to get from here to there? What kind of heights do you go at? How long does it take to build? All these different kind of stuff. The ending drama, the crisis at the end on the space elevator seems to be just another excuse to say, hey, let's get close, up close and personal with a space elevator and see it at this very, very, very close up detail. So I guess it really does. I think this end crisis works a lot better than the one in Rendezvous with Rama, because that was something like, oh, and then some religious people are like angry or something. Whereas this is like, ah, something has gone wrong. We need to save these people. Let's get up close and personal with the space elevator now that it's mostly built. And the characters, like I say, it's interesting. It starts off with this Singh and then moves on to Vannevar Morgan. And he is pretty much the only character which is, those two characters are the only ones that are fleshed out at all. Other ones are mentioned. There's this guy, I can't remember his name, it's like the Venerable Anathema de Mababravanabhar, because it's got like this long long name in Taprobani or Sri Lankan or however, you know, whatever language that they speak there. But he's the head priest, that's why he's called the Venerable, something like that. And he is like, on the face of it, an interesting character. And then his assistant, his close associate, is called another kind of venerable, this person, but he's actually called Chom Goldberg, who is this mathematician who works on fluid dynamics and meteorological kind of stuff. And he went to this place, to this, what am I trying to call it? This monastery on the top of this mountain, on the top of the, what's the mountain called again? Srikanda Mountain. And he's up there and their little interactions, but they're only there for like a chapter and a half and then they disappear again. You're like, oh, I quite enjoyed those characters. Why can't we have more of those characters? But in the end, they do seem to be more of an obstacle for Vannevar Morgan to get past. There's someone else, Maxine Duval. She's a journalist. And she comes in and out and she seems to be like the closest thing that Vannevar Morgan has to a friend. But again, like the distance of these characters, even the people who keep popping up again and again, it's like, well, that could have been a love interest, but like Vannevar Morgan sacrifices everything about himself. It's like, no, everything is, I'm always wanting to do the biggest thing. We need a powerful leader, personality, like someone who was like King Kalidasa. It's like, we need that kind of figure now to push these things through and to make people work and to, you know, rally the troops and to get everything together to get one of these things built. I'm not building fountains in paradise. I'm building a gateway to heaven. It's just as important. This is what I'm doing, and it takes me. And his, all of the things about his or his other interactions with other people always seem to come down to that. It's like, no, I would be really good friends with this person, but I can't because this other thing is more important. Oh, I've got a sister who's got a son, and my nephew is coming to visit me. And oh, well, that would be good that I would have had time to spend with him. But this other thing comes up, and it's more important. This is more important. And he talks about the one point he mentions his wife. A little bit of writing that I like. It's like, oh yeah, I was married to Ingrid, and then I separated from her. And then the line was, she went on to make three other men moderately unhappy. And it's like, well, yes, okay. So we had an unhappy marriage, an unhappy wedding that didn't work out. But the more important thing is that I'm going to going to dedicate my life to this other thing. And I was thinking, well, is this what Arthur C. Clarke was like? Because I was reading his Wikipedia page before, and I knew he was kind of gay or bisexual or something like that. It was always, you know, it's that was kind of the view of him. And in Wikipedia, the quotes on Wikipedia say, yeah, that's right. He had a long-term boyfriend who was buried with. This book itself is dedicated to his long-time companion, his most perfect friend, and things like that. And there's this character in this book called Kingsley, who is Vannevar Morgan's like second in command, and there's like a lot of respect between them. And Kingsley isn't, it's not said that he's married and Vannevar Morgan isn't married, but you're always thinking, oh, maybe this is that kind of like slight reflection. Again, I don't want to read too much into it, but it feels like there's something between the two of them. And at the end, that is the strongest relationship. Even though he's the second in command, it's like there's this mutual respect, which is like, of course, they're probably not sexual lovers, but there's some kind of deeper relationship there. But it's kind of hidden. It's just hinted at. And I'm thinking that could have been a more interesting story. I mean, I think it would have got in the way of the main story a bit too much, but it would have been nice to have like a main character who by the end of it is like, I've always been telling myself that my work is the most important thing, and that's why I don't have these, that's why I never got married, or that's why I don't have children, or that's why I don't build these or let these strong relationships get to me. But it seems like it could have been a thing where it's like, oh, well, actually, I was just using all of that to kind of like hide my sexuality or kind of deny my sexuality. Again, I'm not saying that's what Arthur C. Clarke was, but it seems like this is the book which kind of reflects that most. Because also, this is set in Sri Lanka, or fictionalized Sri Lanka, and Arthur C. Clarke lived in Sri Lanka for 50 years or however long it was himself. So this is obviously a very personal book with him. And is he going, oh, my work is the most important thing, and some of these other relationships have to be hidden or reduced, or I have got to tell them that they have to be hidden or reduced? I'm not entirely sure. What else have I got to say about that? Yeah. Oh, and also the thing that I like about Vannevar Morgan is that, like I say, because he's such an engineer, he doesn't see his relationship with the world through other people so much, or those he kind of diminishes the relationships with other people. But what he does see his relationship to the world is more through his engineering. You know, it's like, I want to be remembered for my engineering. I want to be remembered for this. My name is going to be like, the Gibraltar Bridge is called the Gibraltar Bridge, but it should really be called the Vannevar Morgan Bridge. Or is it? I can't remember. And then at the end, you know, he's going, oh, about the elevator. It'll be called the Vannevar Morgan elevator. I don't want to spoil the end, because we, at the end of the book, we actually skip forward quite a long way. There's an epilogue which is set thousands of years, about as far after this book is set after the building of the Yakagala ruins. Sort of like, that's kind of set 2,000 years after the Yakagala ruins were built, and then the epilogue is set about 2,000 years after the space elevator was built. And they're going, hey, even though this was, you know, these two things, you know, these ruins here and the space elevator were actually built 2,000 years apart. And and then we find out who the elevator is named after. Is it named after Morgan, or is it named after something else, or somebody else, or someone else, some it else? So yeah, he kind of sees his life, the most important things that we find about his childhood is like, yes, I used to build kites, and I did this, and I did that, and the space elevator is kind of like a kite. It's got a long thing string, and there's something up there, and he tells the stories about that. So what else have I got to say about the story and the characters? Not a lot. Characters, like I say, the main guy is kind of interesting in a way, and his relationships are kind of interesting, and there's a few interesting characters, but a lot of them are very flat. It's like, we need a political leader. Here he is. What is he? He's got a name and a position, but that's pretty much all. And this journalist is just a journalist, and yeah, she has feelings. Oh, this is one of the things that kind of goes bad about this is at the end they say there's this rescue mission, and the person that is being rescued isn't really, or the people being rescued isn't someone I really care about. And I think he kind of missed a beat, that it could have been the person being rescued could have been one of these people who the main character, Vannevar Morgan, has a previous history with. It could have been like the journalist, or it could have been his second in command, Kingsley, or it could have been the diplomat that we were talking about before, Singh. There's a few other people that it could have been, or it could have been his nephew who turns up at the last minute. You know, there's lots of things that, that there could have been somewhere that it's like, ah, we've got to save that person because that person has to be saved. Whereas in the end, it was just like, oh yeah, there's some scientist and his assistants and a pilot. That's it. And you're like, really? We're going to go through all of this? A third of the book is going to be dedicated to these people that we have only been introduced in the last third of the book. Could have been someone else. So what do I want to move on? Oh yeah, science and technology. Now, here we go. Or first things, the front cover of this book, or the image on the audiobook, is a space elevator that goes down to Florida. And I'm like, why is it going down to Florida? That doesn't make any sense at all. It's like people don't know what the space elevator is, and the whole point of this book is that it has to go down to this very specific mountain in this very specific fictionalized country. But then looking at the on the Fountains of Paradise page on Wikipedia, it says, first cover of first UK edition, and it shows a mountain. And if you actually look up on the image search of Srikanda, no, what are the names here? I've got to scroll back up my notes. So Srikanda, the mountain is Sripada, and Sripada actually looks very much like the front cover of the first edition of Fountains of Paradise, which is, I think, is pretty cool. And yet on the one on that's on Goodreads, there's a space elevator that goes all the way down to somewhere in South America. And I'm thinking, why are they not on these covers of the books? Why is the space elevator always going down to the wrong place? Just make it go down to the right place. That's not a criticism of the book itself, but I think it's very funny that it's such a specific thing. It's like, yeah, this is where it goes. This is where the space elevator has to go, whereas all the books just seem to miss that point, or quite a few of the books seem to miss this point. There's 62 editions of this book, so I'm sure some of the front covers get it right, like the first edition does. So, what was my second note about this? Oh, yeah, second. I think it's very funny because this is one of the first explorations or popularizations of the concept of the space elevator. The space elevator is an old idea. Let me just click on the Wikipedia page. They mentioned this Russian guy who came up with the idea in 1880-something. 1895, Konstantin Slavkovsky, as a freestanding tower reaching from the surface of the Earth to the height of a geostationary orbit. Says, like all buildings, his structure would be under compression, supporting the weight from below. Since 1959, most ideas for space elevators are focused on purely tensile structures. And it mentions, early concepts, it says, in 1979, space elevators were introduced to a broader audience with the simultaneous publication of Arthur C. Clarke's novels Fountains of Paradise, which engineers construct a space elevator on top of a mountain peak. And Charles Sheffield's first novel, The Web Between Worlds, which I don't think I've read, or I don't think I recognize it at all, also features building of a space elevator. This whole idea is now certainly part of science fiction, but it's also kind of part of science now. You've got these different, like the SpaceX, there's like a SpaceX Space Elevator Award, and I think Google has an award, or maybe it's the Google SpaceX Prize now. But you've got these ideas where people are actually working on this kind of stuff, and they've been featured in movies very much, but the whole idea of having something in geostationary orbit with that is—it's so much part of science fiction that now people just use them in their science fiction stories without ever thinking, "Hey, I've got to explain what a space elevator is." It's like saying, "Hey, this is faster than light travel," and you don't have to go. And faster than light travel means that when you go from one place to the other place, you have to, you know, this is that you travel faster than the speed of light, because the speed of light is this, and that's the natural speed limit for the whole universe. Or this is a warp drive. It's like you just can say it's a warp drive. It's an it's a laser, or it's a, well, I guess lasers are real now. But like Time Machine, you know, when you actually read the Time Machine for the first time, it's like, oh, and when you travel through time, you're actually there, but you're not there because you're being spread out over all of the different times. So you're actually like in between the atoms and stuff like that. Oh, not between the atoms, but you know, you're not visible for people who are there in the times in between. You travel from one time to the other time. And H.G. Wells explains all of this, but since he explained all of that, now science fiction just say, we travel through time. It's like, but where are you when you're traveling through time? Where are you in this time when you're traveling? You can just skip over all of those things. And so it's very funny reading at the beginning of this book where Vannevar Morgan is explaining to someone, like, what is a space elevator? And it's good to have it all laid out again for the first time, even though, you know, you read Red Mars and all of these other books and all these other things with space elevators in them. But it's quite funny to go back and actually go, no, this Arthur C. Clarke had to really explain all of this stuff really closely, really carefully, because this is the first time that 99.9% of the people reading the book had ever come across a space elevator. So this becomes the textbook. After Fountains of the Paradise and some of these other books, it's like, no, this is it. Once you've read this book, you don't need to go over this kind of stuff time and time and time again. You just need to explain, oh, it's possible because of carbon nanotubes. Or in this book, it's kind of like, oh, there's this like quasi one-dimensional or quasi two-dimensional carbon structure, so, but it's not pure carbon, it's some other stuff. What does he call it? A hyperfilament. That's what it says here on Wikipedia. A thin but strong hyperfilament that makes the elevator possible. It's continuous pseudo one-dimensional diamond crystal. One-dimensional. A Buckminster fullerene. And like carbon nanotubes is where it's all now. People, you know, when they to go, oh, carbon nanotube. Oh, will carbon nanotubes one day be able to make us a space elevator? That's what the news is now. Whenever we come up with a new kind of like what's the other one? The carbon, not nanotubes. The carbon. I can't remember what it's called now. The flat one. The flat carbon, not the tubular carbon. My brain's gone dead. Whatever the new carbon is that everyone's talking about, that people are winning Nobel Prizes for. So what was I going to say? Yeah, so it's fun to have this as being the first exploration, and it all still makes sense. It's actually good to go back and have it like that. So other things aside from the space elevator that Arthur C. Clarke gets quite right, he has this idea of like, oh, and everyone will have a computer terminal, if not in their room. They'll have it, like, if they're in a hotel, there'll be one in the lobby, and you can go down, and the whole world will be indexed and searchable, and you'll be able to get hold of anyone. As long as you've got their number or know their name, you can look it up and stuff like that. And I really like all of that kind of idea that he was, like, predicting what it would be like to have the internet. And however, of course, he didn't see the mobile phone revolution. So a lot of it is like, yes, and then he got to a terminal. Are you at your terminal? Yes, I'm at my terminal. Nobody can carry the terminal with them. And there's another time where he says, oh, and I was modeling this thing and I need to do all of this. And like, oh, well, how will you pay for the computer time? And I really like the idea of someone having to pay for computer time. But then I was thinking, no, actually, that's what people do now. It's not just big research projects which go on where you have to pay for computer time. It's also like when you, with the Amazon S3 services and things like that, you can just go, right, I need all of this processing time. I could build the computer myself to do the processing, make all these servers and connect them all together. Or I could just say to Amazon, hey, make me a new virtual server collection, and you just go, yes, and I'll pay for that. So I quite like the idea. Back then, he's like, there will be a computer, and you will pay for someone to enter in all your data, and then you will hire the computer for that time, and then someone will do a printout for you, and at the end, you will have that kind of stuff. But the whole concept of paying for computer time has been automated by Amazon and, I guess, other cloud computing services. But that's still a thing, I guess. So he does that. There's another thing, which is like this this computer personality, artificial intelligence, which is like, and people asked Ari. I think it was like Ari something else, but they shortened it down to Ari. And everyone would say, hey, I need some information. Ari, can you tell me this? And that's kind of what Google has become, crossed with Siri, I guess. So it's like Siri and Google back together, that everyone will say, hey, Ari, I need to know this. Tell me about this. And people have like competitions about how quickly they can look stuff up. I think one of them was like, what was the highest temperature in the smallest country in this place on the day that this baseball team shut out this other team over these so many times. So it's not something that you can just look up, like you can just type in or just say, Ari, tell me this. Ari will be like, oh, that's a bit too complicated. I'm not sure exactly how it was, but there was, these different characters. I think the journalist and Vannevar Morgan himself is just like, yeah, let's get on and have a competition. Okay, first, 3, 2, 1, go. And that becomes like the new academic... It becomes the new academic, school pursuit competition that they do between universities or between people. It's not just about, like, how much do you know? Because how much you know isn't really that important when everyone can find anything. It's like, how many layers of information can you do a cross-reference search between and still get the answer that you want at the end, which isn't something that anyone has ever asked Google before. So while a lot of this stuff is interesting and prescient, a lot of it is very, very dated. It's sort of like, all you have to do is remember your own phone number. And it's like, well, do people, I don't remember any phone number. The only phone number I remember that's still relevant is my parents' phone number, because that used to be my home number. And I don't know any other phone number. It's just not something I do. I have computers to remember that all with me. So it's funny that he envisions a time when all of the world's knowledge is indexed except your own phone number, and you've got to remember that for yourself. Maybe you'll write it down on a bit of paper so you can look it out, I'm not sure. So there's lots and lots of technology which is meant to be in the future, but it's very dated. But then, conceptually, it's not dated. Just the way that it's accessed is dated. It's like, oh, and the person went here into that terminal. This book could easily be rewritten for today, but it wouldn't even have to be rewritten. It's just that whenever they talk about... the terminals that they use or the phone calls that they make or some of the technology that they make could very easily be brought up to date just with modern nouns and slightly modern concepts. So I quite enjoyed reading what he thought the world would be like in the future back in 1980. And we've caught up with it already and surpassed it in very many other ways. Other things that I liked about this is more of the societal reaction to these big projects. There's this fun passage at the beginning where he's saying, oh, well, of course, all the cars, they drive themselves. We have self-driving cars now. So we don't need edges on the bridges, because if anything goes wrong on a car on the Gibraltar Bridge, even though you're 3,000 meters above the sea, we don't need barriers on the edge, because the car will just stop itself and then we'll send a pickup truck and we can recover the car, no problem at all there. So that was a fun idea. But also people were saying, no, that can't be, we need edges. It's like, yeah, but of course, but we'll only need these edges once every 50, statistically, we'll only need the edges to stop a car going off the edge once every 15 years. It's like, well, we're still going to put the barriers along the edge. It's the idea of how people would view these works of technology. And if they would do it, if they would go across a bridge that's 3,000 meters high. Turns out, yes, it becomes very popular. It's sort of like these tallest buildings. Nobody would ever go to the top of this building because, when you get to the top of it, you wouldn't even be able to breathe very well and people would be scared to do it. It's like, well, it turns out it becomes a tourist attraction. It just becomes a thing. Nobody will want the Eiffel Tower because the Eiffel Tower will be really, really ugly and nobody will want it. And in the end, it just becomes an accepted part of life. And there's a great quote saying, oh, the space elevator will be so dangerous, nobody will want to go up the space elevator because it will be perceived to be so dangerous. And he said, well, they said the same thing about cars. If you go above 25 miles an hour, you won't be able to breathe because of the air pressure against your chest. And when the trains go so fast, it'll mess up society in this way. And nobody will want to go on a plane because, it'll be perceived as too dangerous. And they said the same thing about the space shuttle. And I was like, wait, back up a bit. When was this book written? 1978, 1979. Space shuttle was one of those things that goes, oh, everyone will just be going up and down in the space shuttle. Space shuttle is the way of the future. Way of the future, way of the future. This is what everyone's going to be doing. And I was just thinking, actually, the safety record for the space shuttle is to the point where, if someone said to me, do you want to go to space in the NASA space shuttle program, in the orbiters, the Challenger and the Columbia. It's like, would you want to go up in one of those where there was only 5 of them ever built and 2 of them broke down and in 130 missions, 12 people died in 2 explosions or breakups and stuff like that. So again, actually, space shuttle, if there's like a 2 in 130 chance that I won't get down alive, tell you what, I'll take one of these other spaceships, one of these capsules where, like, for how many missions there have been in the, in just a normal space capsule that sticks on, goes on top of the rocket rather than on the side of the rocket. I think I would go up in a normal space capsule, which is, seems to be a lot safer. I'm not sure about the statistics of that, but again, going into space is still dangerous if you do it on a space shuttle. Probably less dangerous if you do it otherwise. But yeah, in the future, that will become part of it. But I like the space shuttle. This was written before two different space shuttle disasters. What else are we going to see? Oh yeah, and it also talks about talking about like how can it used to be that one person wouldn't be able to cause that much damage to anyone because the technology wasn't big enough that one person acting alone would be able to do much damage. It would take a whole fleet of ships, or it would take a whole sky full of aeroplanes and bombs and stuff to be able to destroy a whole city. But now it can take one person acting alone. And I'm like, wow, that's also quite prescient before like 9/11, which wasn't just one person acting alone, but a very small group of people caused a massive amount of damage. You're saying, oh, and someone... how many people does it take out a city? You know, how much damage can be done by just one person or a small group of people acting alone? And I also quite like some of the more dangerous implications of technological progress as well that comes up in this book. What are the themes coming? Oh, I'll talk a bit more. Let's go on to the writing is pretty good. It moves along quite briskly. Like I say, there's a lot of the times not a lot of happening. It's just like, oh, politics here and funding here and engineering here. There's not a lot of other stuff going on, but the writing is solid and just well written. Nothing really to complain about. I know that's like damning with faint praise, but like when so many of these other books, you're reading them, you just go, wait, how do you open your mouth in a frown? How do you do this? Like when going from these other books where people are actually describing things which are literally impossible or not even describing them, it's just sort of like with The Paladin of Souls and by Lucmus Mashabajol, there's so much of it's just, you're not describing what this person is doing, you're giving me stage directions, so if I was in these situations, what would I do in that situation? Yeah, think of that, that's what they're doing. And you're like, well, that's not very helpful. None of that kind of stuff here. Also, I listened to this on Audible, so what I'd normally say is that, hey, you should check out Audible, free audiobook for you. You can choose any one of 200,000 audiobooks, and you might as well choose this one. Go to audibletrial.com/SFBRP and you can not only start a free trial today when you get your free audiobook, you also help support me and the SFBRP and my own reading habits. So I do suggest that, and I do actually suggest this book. It's a very good reading. However, it's very strange. I went over to Audible, typed in Fountains of Paradise, two different books come up, written by Arthur C. Clarke, narrated by Mike Grady, length 8 hours 57 minutes, format unabridged. And I'm like, oh, that's good. But also, check it out, written by Arthur C. Clarke, narrated by Mark Vitor, length 8 hours 28 minutes, which is about half an hour shorter, format unabridged. There's two different versions here, and I'd never listened to anything by Mike Grady before, but I had listened to something by Mark Vitor. I can't remember what, but I looked it up at the time. Maybe I'll just click on his name. Oh yeah, he also did some of the narrating in Hyperion, and I quite like that book as well. Also Lucifer's Hammer, I listened to that as an audiobook, and so I knew he was a good audiobook narrator, no problem at all. But then when I listened to the two samples, and this is a good thing about Audible, you can listen to the sample to see, hey, do I like this person's voice or not? Am I going to find this person's voice annoying? And out of the two, Mike Grady had a slightly slower speaking voice, and also he had an English accent. And when it comes to accents, I would be like, yeah, I think I'll listen. I prefer to listen to an English accent a lot longer than an American accent. That's just purely because I'm English and I have one myself. And also I knew this book was not set in America. It was mostly set in Sri Lanka and with non-Americans. I'm not sure how many Americans there are in the book. There's a few. But the main character is from Australia, and I thought I'll go with the English narrator. I mean, I'm guessing Mike Grady is English. He had a good English accent. And then, so he actually does some of these accents quite well. However, I'm thinking, hey, is this Australian accent? Is that a good Australian accent? Because the main character, Vannevar Morgan, is Australian. And he always says this stuff. And I'm like, is that what he would speak like? Or would he, like, if someone is this kind of character, would he have less of an Australian accent or more of an Australian accent? That kind of thing. Every time he said something, I was like, wow, he's got an Australian accent. And so I'm not saying it's a good accent or a bad accent. I'm not good enough to judge if it's an accent or not. But I enjoyed the accent, let me say. It brought his character to life more. Every time this character spoke, we would get this new accent. And I just enjoyed that. So anyway, check it out. audibletrial.com/SFBRP if you want to start a free audiobook trial. I pay, I think it's like $20 or 20 euros a month and get 2 audiobooks a month, and and that's good for me. I sometimes listen to audiobooks which aren't available on Audible from other sources, and I read ebooks and sometimes a paper, some very rarely paper books now, but ebooks as well. And 2 audiobooks a month is perfect for me. So check it out. Moving on, what's next in my notes? Oh yeah, I was saying about one of the characters actually. I think Maxine Duval is a journalist, and she's said to be she's a journalist, but also a professor in electronic journalism. And I'm like, that's really funny that in the future electronic journalism is going to be a thing. And again, I didn't make a note of that, but that's one of those things. So 2 things which is weird about this book. Halfway through, aliens turn up, and you're like, wait. Am I reading Rendezvous Rama or am I reading Founders of Paradise? I had completely forgotten about this section where aliens turn up, the Star Striders and from the Star Home, and it's this robot alien robot that swings through, learns our languages from our radio broadcasts and answers lots of questions and says, hey, not about this. And it's not bad. It's just sort of like, what's this doing here? I understand that at the end of the book, they're wanting to skip forward into the future. And there seems to be like, hey, the future is the stars. Really, we need to get off of Earth. And one of the reasons is we need to go and talk to these guys out over at Starhome 50 light years away, or however long away it's going to be. You know, the whole idea is that we need to get off of Earth seems to be an important one. Suddenly aliens turn up and I'm like, I don't think that's needed. And also, when the alien turns up, the alien says, hey, guess what? Religion isn't true. And it seemed a little bit handy because they had to find a way to get rid of the priests from the top of the mountains, which isn't that. There's actually some other stuff going on that I don't want to get into for plot reasons. It's like, okay, so we need to get rid of the priests from the top of the mountain. But then they're saying, well, the priests aren't real religious priests anymore because nobody believes in God anymore, but then we're doing this other stuff. And it seems to be a bit too handy that suddenly in the future, 50 or 100 years in the future, it's like, oh, guess what? We now have proof that God doesn't exist and it's a purely human thing. So we're all not going to be religious anymore, right? Right? We're just not going to be religious. Okay, yeah. And I'm thinking, I'm not quite sure that's how people's beliefs work. Maybe it is. Maybe in the future, everyone will just be atheist or everyone. But I think that's the kind of thing that I think, if the majority of the world is going to be atheist, I think the majority of the world has to be born atheist. I don't think aliens turning up and saying, actually, you know, there's no God, I don't think that's going to convince everyone. But then again, I don't know. It reminds me a bit of, what's the book? Forever War, where they come back after thousands of years and it's like, hey, and now everyone is gay. And why is everyone gay? Oh, it's handy that everyone is going to be gay now. And I'm like, okay, I know this book is kind of a parable about what it's like to go away and to war, and you come back from war and you've changed, and then the whole world has changed and you can't fit in anymore, and everybody being gay is a clever way of doing that. But I'm thinking that's not really quite how the world works, or how humans work, is it? I'm not really sure. I'm not sure if aliens turn up and said, hey, you know, God doesn't exist, will be any different from like non-alien rational people turning up. But what I do like about this is there's a quick exploration in the book about comparative religion studies, and it's not just like, oh, what about this religion versus this religion? It's like, what about human religion or mammalian religion versus non-human mammalian or earth religion? What would it be like? And I like the idea that that religion only comes up within species that have a mother and a father, a mother, like a nurturing mother and a father. So it's like there is no non-mammal religions. Religions only pop up in places or in species which have a mother and a father and, you know, nurturing stuff. So I guess maybe lizards, egg-laying animals, birds would have religion, but others won't, I don't know. But anyway, I quite like the idea. However, aliens turning up and the whole religion thing, it was like, why is that in this book? Like, what's going on in this book? There is a good thing about the there's a on the top of the on the top of the mountain, on the top of Srikanda Mountain, there's this footprint, and they're like, yes, this is the footprint of Buddha. And other people go, oh, no, actually, it's the footprint of Jesus. And other people go, and Vannevar Morgan goes up to the head priest, is like, what do you think it's a footprint of? You think it's a footprint of Buddha? And the head priest is like, yeah, the footprint is like 2 meters long. And he doesn't say yes, it is, or no, it isn't. He kind of evades the question by saying, look, you know, the footprint is 2 meters. It's like totally non-historic. So that's it. So I think that's all I want to talk about this book. I do recommend it. I'm going to give it 4 stars. Not because, first of all, because it is the textbook on space elevators. And I don't think there's much talking about space elevators which isn't still relevant, except that, there's this one thing that has to be in this one place. It has to be in Sri Lanka because of gravitational disturbances or whatever. And I think anywhere on the equator would be good. And it's the kind of book that I just wish, like, you know, Jason M. Hoff had read before he wrote The Darwin Elevator, because that goes from Darwin, which isn't on the equator. But then there's another one that goes from Belém in Brazil, which kind of is on the equator. I'm just thinking, I think if you're going to write a science fiction book about space elevators, or if you want to go back to the source text, this is it. Read it all the way through to the end, because you do get a much closer look at it in the crisis section at the end of the last third of the book. So it's lots of really fun engineering stuff and politics stuff and finance stuff and future stuff, which I quite like. It's not a great story, but it's not a bad story. There's not a lot of really interesting characters, but there are no bad characters. Unlike, say, Ringworld, it's sort of like, hey, this is interesting engineering, and then massive amounts of sexism and pure racism, and then and these other books where you just go, wow, this is a really annoying character. There are no really annoying characters. There's characters that I would have been liked to have actually spent more time with them. There's the crazy, what's his name? Dr. I made a note of it. Dr. Chom Goldberg, you know, and these other characters. I was like, hey, more time with these characters. Put these characters back into the story somehow. I'd like these, you know, and some of these characters make really interesting decisions. They're like, well, can we not see how that plays out? But it all comes down to, does it now impact the space elevator anymore? Yes, goes in the book. No, doesn't go in the book. So I actually would like some of these characters a bit more, but no offensive characters. So it's a weird to read a book which is utterly inoffensive in every way. Nothing is bad with the writing. Nothing is bad with the story. It's short enough that what it lacks isn't a distraction, and it gets you through to the end. I'm just like, great, that's what I want from science fiction. Why not just have this from science fiction? And also as a historical, like, it's like reading The Time Machine. Why not read Fountains of Paradise? It is, like I say, the textbook. It is like, it's a historically significant book in a way that some of these other Hugo Nebula Award books aren't. I mean, nobody's going to read The Paladin of Souls and go, wow, that's an important book which has informed science fiction and fantasy from then on. Like, no. I mean, that's not going to happen. Whereas this book, you read it and go, ah, this is actually kind of like one of those quote-unquote important science fiction books. And for one of these quote-unquote important science fiction books, unlike, say, Ringworld, I do think it holds up particularly well. And, like I say, from a historic point of view of, like, the historic view of technology and what technology might be like in the future, not just in the future set in the main part of the book, or the two futures set in the main part of the book, but also, like, that distant future epilogue. I think that's some interesting stuff going on there as well. Just forget about the aliens and the religion thing. You can just kind of put that out of your mind. No matter that it's interesting, it just doesn't fit in the book, so just ignore that as you read it. But even that doesn't detract from the book. You're just like, what? Why is this in here? So that's it. I'm going to go across to goodreads.com and see what other people think about this. So Tamahomi, 3 stars. Jenny from Reading Envy and the Reading Envy podcast. Everyone should read the Reading Envy podcast. It's really good. With Jenny and Scott and guests like Tamahomi and others as well. 4 stars. Jason, 4 stars. So generally it gets 3 and 4 stars. I don't think anyone's... There's a few people giving it 5 stars, but not that many. And then in general, in the community of Goodreads itself, gives it a 3.93. SFBRP listeners, 3.75. So, you know, between 3.5 and 4 stars... for this book is a good average rating. I agree with most of these reviews. So let's give it that. You can become my friends on Goodreads so I can see what you think of books as well. That's really handy. I do actually look through what other people think of books that I'm reading. And if I get a book recommended to me, it's always good to see What SFBRP listeners think of that. It's a great way to kind of gauge whether I want to read a book and if people might be interested in me reading it, if lots of SFBRP listeners have read it. So go to goodreads.com and I outsource my SFBRP listener community there by my friends, and also join the SFBRP listener group. There's always some discussion. There's always a not too much discussion, so you can still join in and keep up with all the discussion there. There's only like maybe 10 posts per week there, like one or two new topics every month, so you can keep up with it. So go to Goodreads and become an SFBRP listener group person. You can email me, luke@juggler.net. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm @LukeBurge on Twitter. I think that's about it, so thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.